Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I am so excited about this interview because I've been looking to understand this founder for years. Here's the thing. He created one of the first form software on the internet, the kind of form that you could put into your website. Believe it or not, that used to be a headache to get a form on your website. A good one anyway. He created it. He monetized it. He built it up. It went really well, and we'll find out how well it went. And then he comes up with this thing called FormSpring, which just took the web by storm for a period there. It was a site where anyone could ask questions and get answers, and it just became this huge social network, and sadly, it went away almost as fast as it started. I was looking at your face just to get a sense of, how do I say this? Is it okay for me to say it went away? I've gotten in trouble with entrepreneurs by saying that one of their businesses failed. People don't like any of that. But it went away, and I was like, what happened? And I know that you've explored it over the years, Ade, so I'm going to ask you about that in this interview. And then he started another company that I don't even know if it's on his LinkedIn profile. And then now he's got a new business called Gel. Gel is software that I want to ask him about because I think we need it. His latest software helps organizations have better team meetings. We had our team meeting a couple hours before this. I think we need some help. It's everybody spending their time together, and I feel like we're wasting some people's time, and I don't like it, so I want to find out about that. All right. Oh, so many questions. I want to find out about, why would this guy who did so well with form software that people were willing to pay for go into social media and then more social sites that no one's paying for? And then did he come back to this tool for businesses that he can charge for because he got burned, or what did he learn over the years? All right, all that is I didn't even introduce you, Ade. What kind of interviewer am I? Ade Olano is the founder of, among other things, Formstack. Formstack, I think of as form software. I've been hearing it called data management solution because it lets you collect data, organize it, pass it on to other software that you use. And Gel, this software that I'm really eager to talk to him about. This whole interview is sponsored by two great companies. The first will organize your books and make sure that you know how much money you're making each month or losing each month, where the money's going, where it's coming from. It's called Bench. And the second is the company that will help you do email marketing right. It's called Active Campaign. Ade, welcome.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here, and thanks for, I'm flattered by that introduction.
So much I got to ask you about. You know what? Let's start with this.
Okay.
Formstack, how much revenue is it bringing in now? Let's say 2017.
2017, we're doing about $14 million in AR.
$14 million annual recurring revenue.
Right. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. The new business Gel is what, like 3 years old now at this point, maybe even four almost, no?
Yeah, it's it depends on when you count. So Gel is actually currently a subsidiary of Formstack. So it really started.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so it kind of started as something we built for ourselves internally. And then we launched kind of an MVP out to the world, trying to validate whether or not something that more people can use other than just us at Formstack. And then really for about 2 years, we've had a small team on it full time. So it's kind of been, fits and starts. So
here's the thing. I want to understand your story and go in chronological order, but I've got to start with this first because it's just been on my mind for so long. You're a guy who had Formstack. It did so well. I mean, after years of working hard at it, it became a contender, a huge contender against really big giants in the form space. It produced money. Then you go and you start FormSpring. Then I don't see it on your LinkedIn profile, but you started this network. I think it was called Loop, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Where Loop. People, it was like Twitter, but for every post there was a GIF.
Yep.
I feel like you're a guy who got the business tool right, the people willing to pay for it, but the whole time you were pining away for like Twitter type success, for Tumblr type success. Am I right? And so you moved to those worlds, and now you're coming back with Gel to the business world where you can sell software.
Yeah, so you're accurate. I've done quite a number of products and businesses on kind of the B2B side, and then some on B2C side. I would say I have always just been a builder and experimenter, and so if there's any secret to what success I've had, it's that for everything that you might see on my LinkedIn profile or that anybody's touched, there's probably five other things that I've built, or, you know, that maybe nobody's, you know, ever seen except for a close circle of friends. And, you know, from kind of early on in my career, it's just, I get an idea, I experiment with it, maybe build an MVP and kind of tinker around with it, and then, yeah, see where it goes, and then kind of double down on the things that are successful and then continue to iterate there.
I see. So it's not that you're hiding it from your LinkedIn profile. It was just one of many experiments. I just happened to have noticed that one, but there were others. Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. And I should say Formspring was incredibly successful. We're going to talk about that. The first thing that I do see on your LinkedIn profile is something called Bottled Software.
Yeah.
This is a company that you started?
Yeah, this is a company I started in college, so as a senior in college. And kind of the background behind that is I got into web development as a freshman in college and did freelance work all throughout college to kind of pay my way through college and you know, get spending money. And basically as a senior, this dates me a little bit, but I'd say one of my biggest influences was the movie Office Space, where basically I just kind of looked at that reality after college, and I said, you know what, I'm having a lot of fun, and I'm able to support myself doing web development on my own, and you know, I don't want to go work for some, you know, large company.
So Office Space was the thing that you were trying to avoid for your life. That
was
kind
the thing
of
I was trying it. To. So, you know, I think that came out my junior year, and me and my buddies, you know, we watched it, I don't know, probably a dozen times, you know, and basically just started having conversations with a few of my friends in school and said, you know what, what if I just kind of take this freelance business and, you know, we kind of join, you know, team up and then see if we can keep doing that full time. And that's kind of what we did.
And it did well. But you said, look, consulting is great. I want to have software. You created content management software. What specifically was it?
Yeah, so Bottled Software really started out, you know, did a lot of custom development for clients and you know, programming. But one of our first clients was actually my alma mater, Anderson University. And basically, the problem that they had is had this, you know, sprawling website with content for, you know, everywhere from, you know, alum to admissions to sports, and really no good way to manage that. So at the time, this was back in 2000, at the time, you know, this was obviously pre-WordPress, pre-all the content management systems we use today. And, you know, all that was really out of the market was these big enterprise solutions that you'd pay, you know, six, seven figures for and, you know, a lot of consulting fees. And so really saw an opportunity to build kind of a lightweight content management system for them. We called it WebTwist. And so they were one of our first clients, and we built WebTwist for them. And then kind of the light bulb went off, and really, you know, at my heart and, you know, everybody I was working with, we really wanted to find that one product to work on. We didn't really want to do, you know, consulting work full time. And so ended up kind of productizing WebTwist and going out and reselling that. And so did that for a couple of years. Ultimately we shut it down just because, first of all, you know, really naive and made a lot of mistakes. You know, it was a group of us that, you know, had never really started a business before, never really understood startup world. We probably would have failed regardless, but it was also the wrong time to start a company. So, you know, I graduated in May of 2000, and, you know, we started the company in January of 2000. This was obviously right as, you know, kind of the dot-com bubble was bursting. And basically, you know, towards the end of Bottled Software's life, just had so many conversations with clients who just didn't feel like the internet was really a thing that, you know, that they needed to invest in. And so, you know, our sales cycles just got longer and longer. And, you know, me and my co-founder kind of looked at each other and said, you know what, we could probably make more money if we just went worked at Starbucks or something like that. So let's, you know, let's take a break, go get.
Not only that, I looked at the about page on your site. You apparently racked up a lot of credit card debt.
For Bottled Software?
Yeah, you say, built a CMS called WebTwist, but couldn't sell enough licenses, racked up credit card debt, learned a lot about entrepreneurship, and got married.
Yeah, I don't remember how much the debt, I mean, it wasn't astronomical. It was probably, you know, I think I maxed out a credit card, but, you know, as somebody who's just a recent college grad who I don't think had ever had a W-2 at the time, I probably only had, a couple thousand in, credit limit. So yeah, but yeah, for me at the time, it was definitely significant.
All right, so you were you spent 4 years at a job. How closely did the real life job experience match what you saw in the movies and were scared of?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, it was there was some aspect of it that was pretty similar, but I learned a lot more than I thought I would. And I'm still really happy for that experience, just because, you know, I walked in I worked at Gannett, newspaper media company, large organization, tons of training and processes and systems. And I just really hadn't had, you know, even that exposure to the positive side, I guess, of all that process, right? So, you know, walked in and after a couple of weeks realized just all the things that I did wrong, you know, even just simple things like when we tried to hire people at Bottled Software, we asked all the, you know, the wrong questions, you know, the questions that you're not supposed to ask in an interview, and didn't even, you know, really think about the right way to, you know, hire, the right way to kind of systemize work. And so really learned a lot about that at Gannett. But yeah, at the end of the day, you know,
is there something that you can share with us that you took from working there about systemizing work or doing it better than you did when you were running your own company? Let us learn from your experience. What's one thing that stuck with you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I was exposed a lot more to just kind of the process of, you know, things like Scrum, you know, that I just, you know, we really didn't follow at all in that first company. You know, things like just understanding performance management a little bit better. Now, probably my thinking has evolved since then, but, you know, it was the first time that I had to participate in and implement a formal review process for employees. And so even just thinking through that framework and trying to, you know, also seeing, not just seeing, again, it's partly seeing what's right about it, why you want to do that, but also experiencing that vividly to know what's wrong with it, also kind of helped shape my thinking.
What was wrong with it?
I mean, probably the worst part about it is we did annual reviews, and probably anybody that's gone through annual reviews understands this. You know, there are at least a couple things wrong. One is because everyone's kind of scrambling at the end of the year, or, you know, the period to write the review, whether it's just, you know, self-evaluation or, you know, the management review, it's very has a lot of recency bias. And so, you know, we didn't, I tried to get better at this, you know, as I was there, but have, you know, kind of continuous feedback and, you know, have those conversations throughout the year. But for the most part within the organization, I just felt like most of the things that were discussed were things that you just accomplished in the last, you know, month or two that your manager would remember.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's a good thing that you learned from them? You're right, by the way, that happens to me all the time, that when I try to give people feedback at the end of the year, it's always the things that happened the last couple of months, because frankly, what happened 10 months ago is not relevant.
Right. Yep, exactly.
So then what's one thing that you learned about how to do that that I could take back to my team about how to give feedback better?
Yeah, I had a lot of great training. You know, I started there just as a developer. After about a year or so, I got promoted into management and so managed a team, and got a lot of great management training around just really. There are a couple principles that stood by me. Probably the most important one that I took from there specifically was. Had some training around just thinking as a manager, it's my job to really understand everybody individually and really understand kind of where they want to head, you know, what direction they want to go personally, professionally, what their goals and objectives are, and then figure out how to align the organization or team objectives in the same way. And basically, you know, there's most harmony when those arrows are all lining up the same way. And it was a way of thinking about management, a framework about thinking that I hadn't thought about that before, and really understanding how to, you know, figure out people's strengths and kind of double down on those strengths to get those arrows to align rather than focusing on people's weaknesses. My perception from Office Space, from, you know, you know, those crappy high school jobs was that management is all about really figuring out what people are doing wrong and identifying those and calling those out, versus really trying to understand, you know, what's your core strength and what, you know, what's your motivation, where do you want to head, and how can I help you get there in a way that aligns with the organization. So it's really kind of that you know, thought process.
Yeah, that's the what's the name of the author of the book? This is a Strengths Finder approach, right?
Yeah.
Is it Tom Rath? No, it's wait. First, discover your strengths. Hang on, it's coming up right now. Man, why does Google make it so hard to find books? Let's just go straight to Amazon. Marcus, that's what it is. Marcus Buckingham.
Yep, exactly.
Right,
yep.
Great book. I think even Facebook ended up hiring him to come in and teach their people.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that. I'm pretty sure that he might even still be there right now as not a full-time employee, but as a consultant who trains their people.
Yeah.
It's also a well-written book, too.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite management books, yep.
Okay, and then your wife got pregnant, and you do what?
Yeah, so really the last kind of, you know, my last year there, I was, you know, I was still learning a lot, but I really started to, the longer I was there, the more I kind of itched to jump back into entrepreneurship, and knew that I wanted to build my own things, and, you know, not necessarily, you know, rational necessarily in terms of, you know, career and all that stuff. It was just, I just knew I wasn't going to be happy until I did that. And so really had this long internal struggle about what's the right time, what's the right idea, and kind of, you know, bounce back and forth, you know, between a lot of different answers to those questions. And really, talked with my wife about it quite a bit. And she just really kind of gave me permission to say, you know, you're not going to be happy unless you do this. We wanted to have children. And so she was pregnant with, you know, our first son. And basically, I picked the wrong time to quit, which is essentially 2 weeks before he was born. So
did you talk about it with her?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We talked about it a lot.
You know what? Sorry to interrupt. In the early interviews that I did, I would have just brushed right past it. Now that I've got two young kids, I remember what it's like before they're born. Yes, there's all this excitement, but I also would have this worry. Not about how am I going to take care of them or myself in the next 6 months. It's I got 16 years and 18 and 20, and it's just going to go on. And then you see people who, you know, when they need to come back home in their 30s because of whatever issue, I'm going to need to be there for them. Did any of that go through your head?
Yeah, it did. But really, so this may be what you're saying, but I think what really kind of drove me was thinking about, so having a child, you know, at least for me, and I've heard this from a lot of other parents, is when you have your first child, you start thinking much longer term, and you start thinking more about, you know, maybe more about legacy than about what's, you know, what are my career goals in the next, you know, year to 5 years. And what really kind of, my wife and I talked about it a lot. And what I realized is, like, I'm not going to be a great father if I come home drained and, you know, miserable about work.
Yes.
And, you know, is this really the life that I want, where I'm going to be, you know, that person, you know, 20 years from now, regretting that I stayed in a job or a situation that I didn't.
You'd be like the dad in the Wonder Years who his kid only remembers him as grumpy.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's funny. I didn't realize at the time, but, you know, the more people I've talked to, I found more and more people who kind of made big life decisions right before, you know, in kind of the weeks and months before their first child. And I think it's because of that. So, you know, basically knew, all right, I need to do this.
So what were you going to do? What was the work that you were going to do?
Yeah. So basically I quit, you know, 2 weeks before he was born. And I kind of did that because, I kind of calculated it that, at least I'd have, you know, we'd have health insurance coverage through the end of the month. So that was kind of like the latest, you know, or kind of earliest that I could quit and still have, health insurance. And I really didn't, I also kind of got to that point where, probably about a year prior, I'd had some ideas and, you know, kind of tinkered on nights and weekends, but, you know, my job at the time was pretty demanding, so I wasn't able to give it my full focus attention. So I just kind of came to that point where I'm just going to quit. And then after I quit, I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do.
I see. And partially it's because of something that Matt Mullenweg said to me. I said, aren't you afraid to get into WordPress? And he said, no, I'm a developer. I could always find work. My sense is you were a developer. Now you had experience working for yourself, lots of clients, building your own CMS, content management software. Content management system, I think, is what a CMS is. And so you had lots of experience, and you said, I will find some work, and I'll also start to create products, and one of them will take off.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I had, I had a lot of worry, but yeah, you're right. I felt like, you know, there was enough of a, you know, it was a blurry path, but there was a path back to figuring out how I could feed myself and my young family. I felt like I needed to kind of completely sever that cord to really give myself the freedom and flexibility to figure out what it, what I was going to work on. So I had a handful of ideas. Formstack was the first thing I worked on.
Well, let me take a moment to talk about my sponsor, and then I'll ask you where you came up with the idea for Formstack, because it's something that I've heard in lots of other interviews about where great ideas come from. But first, the company that's sponsoring this interview is called Bench. Bench is software and a team of people who do your books. You know, they keep track of where your revenues are coming from, where your expenses are, etc. Who did in the early days your books?
So I downloaded QuickBooks, yep. The very early days, then myself, and then ended up finding a bookkeeper, kind of locally to individual
bookkeeper.
Yeah.
So you know what? I did QuickBooks for a long time too, and it was such a nightmare because you said, you have to download it. Now they even have a web version. It's just such a pain in the butt. So what Bench wanted to do is modernize the software, but also say, look, you as a business owner shouldn't have to do this. And you as a business owner shouldn't have to go out and get a bookkeeper to do it, because first of all, you're going to have to do a lot of interviewing, and you should interview for people who change the course of your business, not someone who's going to keep track of where the money's coming from. And you should have a team of people. And here's why a team is important. Just a couple of months ago, I decided, you know what? My business books are taken care of. Why don't I have my personal books taken care of? Where is all this money coming from? I mean, going. My wife and I make a good living. I don't take every dollar out of Mixergy and bring it home. I take a good amount. She makes a good salary. Where's all this money going? So I decided I'm going to hire someone from Upwork. And I said, I need you, you pick the software, answer these questions so that I could figure out who the right person is. And I need you to do my books on a monthly basis and get on a call with me. So I found a bunch of people. I picked Peggy because she was the best of the lot. And Peggy's good. But here's the thing. I'm supposed to talk to her on Thursday, and she pings me using the Upwork messaging system to say, Andrew, I'm doing a lot of W-2s right now, or 1099s, I guess. Do you mind if we do it a week later? I'm going, no, my calendar's set. I can't do it a week later. And then there was another issue over the holidays that she couldn't do it. I totally understand it, by the way. W-2s are more important than figuring out where my wife is spending money on clothes or food or whatever it is, right? I get it. For the holidays, same thing comes up. People have lives. People have issues. I totally, totally get it. I don't want that for my business. I don't want a single person to be the point of failure when it comes to my books. That's why I like working with an organization that has a team of bookkeepers. First of all, the software does the work, which QuickBooks is not really there for. Software sucks in the data from Stripe, sucks in the data from everywhere else, your credit cards, your bank information, puts it all in, organizes it as best as possible, and then a real human being goes in and makes some adjustments, says, hey, you know what? Usually most people want this software categorized this way. Andrew would want to categorize that way. Boom, ba, boom, ba, boom, boom, boom. That's what Bench does. If you guys are interested in having your books done right, and really what you want is to know the score in your business on a month-to-month basis, it's like, I don't play video games, but you know what? If I go out and I play a video game and they show me points, I want to try to beat my points. I'm now bike riding in the backyard because I got kids. I don't have time to go out for long runs anymore. It sucks. But at night, I can get on this bike and I'm using this app that tells me how many miles I've ridden, how high I would have ridden like in this virtual world. I want to beat that. Last night I was exhausted. I still wanted to beat it. If you get points, you naturally want to beat it. And that's the thing about having good books. If you see your points on a regular basis, if meaning your profit and loss, your expenses and income, you're going to want to keep beating it month after month after month. And that's what Bench will do. It'll get it done right for you. If you're listening to the sound of my voice, they're going to give you 20% off your first six months with Bench. And because some people in my audience were kind of pains in the ass about it, and they found that they were offering at Bench a better deal than they offer me with my special URL, Sachit went back to Bench and said, come on, give us something better, or else the Mixergy audience is going to complain to Andrew. Here's what they said. They're now going to give us a free trial. That means, look at this. These guys are going to do work for you to get your books organized for free, just so you can see how great it is to have your books done right. Go to bench.co/Mixergy, bench.co/Mixergy, and you're going to get that plus so much more. And don't forget to look down at that quote on the very bottom from Jason Fried. If you know him, you know how valuable that quote is on their website, bench.co/Mixergy. All right. You were doing consulting work and something kept happening over and over. What was that?
Yeah. So, I, again, engineer by trade, so would try to, find large programming projects and had some great projects. But then somewhere in there, my client inevitably would say, "Hey, can you build me a contact form for my website?" Or, this contact form to grab some leads. And that just kept happening over and over. As a programmer, that's kind of boring work. It's not really fun engineering work to create a form that capture some data and send it via email.
And this was on static websites or WordPress sites?
Static websites. So this was even still back. I forget exactly when WordPress launched. I think 2008, maybe 2007, something like that. So it may have been right as WordPress was launching or before that. So it'd either be a static site or kind of embedded within some other CMS.
I see. And they said to you, "Hey, you know what? We need..." Actually, the initial release of WordPress was 2013. I'm looking at Wikipedia, but Matt Mullenweg took over from something else, I think a little bit after that. Actually, WordPress released 2003. Excuse me, 2003. Matt Mullenweg and Mike Little.
Sure.
But it wasn't prevalent back then. So you were building static websites and people kept asking you for forms. There were these forms, there were scripts online. Couldn't you just go get one of those scripts and put it on their site and call it a day?
Yeah. So probably the most, probably most programmers around that time would use something from what was called Matt Script Archive. So basically, CGI scripts that you could download and plop on your site. They were riddled with security, bugs, and you'd have to customize it some way. So, I might be able to, find a fairly, robust CGI script that I could download and pop on somebody's site. But inevitably they'd say something like, I want it to, if they put in this information, send it to this email address versus this email address, or I don't want to just get an email. Can you put in a database so I can, dump that into a spreadsheet or something like that?
What were people trying to do with their forms? I remember contact forms were the natural, easy request. What else were they trying to do with forms back then? What were they asking you to build?
Yeah, contact forms are probably the most most prevalent thing. It was also a lot of internal stuff too. So basically, I'm trying to think of a great example, but I may have a say I'm a nonprofit and I have a list of donors and I want to send out a form to all of them to collect some information from a from a list versus embedding that form on my website. So okay. All sorts of different use cases.
So you just kept doing it over and over again. By the way, Matt's Script Archive is still up and running right now. It's not being used at all. It doesn't seem like anyone has touched it since maybe 2009. The What's New section has a post from July 14, 2009, but it's an interesting relic of what people used to do with these scripts.
Yeah, Matt Script Archive, I think dated back to, I remember using it in college. It dated back
1995.
To 1995.
It says it at the very top. Yeah. Offering free CGI scripts to the web community since 1995, !
Yeah, Matt was awesome. And I should probably look to see what he's doing right now. But if I remember correctly, it was just some, I think he was a high school student when he first launched that and just had a bunch of scripts that he could, stack counters and stuff like that.
Couldn't you just go and say, "Look, guys, I know you want a new form on your site. There's SurveyMonkey. Let's just link out to SurveyMonkey survey and be done with it."
Yep. Yeah. So SurveyMonkey was the thing out there, essentially the SaaS tool before we all called it SaaS, that you would use if you wanted a survey. SurveyMonkey back then was horribly ugly. It was slow. It was, created before kind of, Ajax, enabled applications. So, you had a lot of clicks and steps to just create that form. And so, and it really, you know, it worked fine for a survey, but it didn't work at all for embedding on your website. It didn't work at all for really, like, you know, the ability to customize it or anything. And so, so at the time, so this was in early 2006 that I started working on Formstack. At the time, Ajax, you know, technology was becoming more ubiquitous. So this was, you know, about a year or two after, you know, kind of Gmail really popularized this, and saw an opportunity not only to solve that problem that we talked about, where I could just give somebody a tool and they can kind of create their own form and it has all that functionality without, you know, me having to code up the HTML or anything like that. And could do that in a nice, like, drag and drop kind of slick way. So the timing was also right too, in that, you know, it brought, you know, it was able to have just a much more user-friendly tool to do that. So yeah, so it wasn't just the, and it wasn't just the, like, processing part, which was, you know, kind of the Matt Script Archive piece of it, but it was also the, like, having to code up all the, you know, HTML inputs and drop downs and all that stuff. So, you know, that people needed as well. So okay.
So the first version you created 2006, you said, this is going to be my SaaS. This is, well, I don't know if you called it SaaS at the time.
Yeah. I didn't call it SaaS at the time, I don't think.
It was called FormSpring, right?
Right. Yep. It was called FormSpring.
I see the original website right here on my screen, thanks to the Internet Archive. Here's under the features, the last item there is you don't have to install anything on your website or local computer. All you need is a web browser and an internet connection.
You still had to explain that at the time.
That
wasn't something you had to download or install. Yeah.
So you built it, you put it up, you told our producer, you know what, I'm a developer, I'm not a designer. It didn't look that great.
It didn't. It was pretty ugly. So, yeah, I did it all myself. You know, I feel like, I cringe when I look at those old screenshots. But, you know, if you compare it to kind of other apps at the time, it wasn't that bad. It was probably, you know, maybe a C- in terms of design.
No, I'm looking at it here. I'm looking for things to bring up to make you smile and kind of laugh at how, like, immature you were as an entrepreneur. But the stuff looks good.
Yeah.
It looks okay. It looks very Windowsy.
Very table. A lot of tables. You know, a lot of kind of, you know, stock icons and stuff like that.
But I can add fields. It was a certain number of fields that I could add into my form. I could set. Actually, here I've got a list here. You told our producer 6 different types of drag and drop fields into your form. There was no conditional logic, meaning if somebody says, I have a sales question, you can't forward that email to the sales department. You can't. There were no integrations. Today, if someone fills out a form, it can go into their email software. And there was an HTML snippet that they could just put on their code. So they were basically embedding your form into their site. That's the heart of it. This is what you were selling for free. If somebody wanted I'm bringing up the price structure. That you were selling at the time, because this was at a point where people, you know, had an issue with charging online. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. It was hard to just get people to take out the credit card and fill.
And you were looked at as a jerk for charging for anything online, because information wants to be free, tools want to be free, why not do advertising? So you did have a free version. The free version allowed for one form, only 15 fields, 50 submissions per form. That was basically it. There wasn't a lot of customization. Yeah. And then it went from $5 up to $50 a month. That was good pricing.
Yeah. It's funny. I actually think probably one of my biggest mistakes with Formstack was probably pricing too low, that $5 plan. I added that kind of at the last minute. I kind of, you know, second guessed myself, got some feedback from a friend, but you know, maybe you should have a really cheap option. And I was kind of like, yeah, I don't know if, you know, will people really buy this? And so added that $5 plan and you know, can't make a lot of money on $5 a month plans, but yeah, that was $5 through $50.
That was a mistake. You shouldn't have had the $5. You shouldn't have listened to your friend. Just go for $12.50 as a starter, right?
Yeah, exactly. The people who pay, you know, basically there's a, you know, there's obviously a line where if you're going to pay for software, and once you kind of cross that, that line, then you're probably willing to pay more than $5 a month.
So yeah.
if you need this software for your business.
All right, so now it's time to get some customers. I see how you built it.
Yep.
Let's understand. Do you remember where you got your first customers?
I didn't have a good process for it. So I told all my friends, told my clients, said, hey, I built this. Can you take a look? Got some great feedback, but really my first customer and regretfully, I've lost who that was, but my first customer, didn't know them, never, they found me online. So, I was posting kind of all over the place, any directory I found, any sort of, article about, related to form building, I was in the comments saying, hey, I just built this, this online form builder, and posting on forums and stuff like that too. And so I assume, they found me somewhere there, but, that's kind of where I found, most of my first customers. And then, over time, within that first year, started to, get some more customers via SEO and started experimenting with PPC. And so got customers that way, as well as people from my network. But.
The early embed code, did it also embed a link back to your site?
I think it did. I can't remember when I added that. I mean, it was pretty early on. I don't know if it was like the very first version, but yeah, that was a big, strategy at some point in terms of, driving SEO.
That's something that I can't find. If you heard a ding dong in the back as we were talking, I was trying to find right now as we were talking one of the early forms to see if I could add more color to the conversation. I couldn't. I ended up finding Spring Fertility's website. They had a form on it, and then they popped up one of those chat boxes. You do remember, though, you told our producer, first month you made $75. Second month?
Yeah.
Do you remember what second month was?
I think it was $73.
$73. Right? So because of churn, you're going backwards. How did that feel?
I went backwards. Did you say how did that feel? The first year was lots of ups and downs, right? Think about the context of, just had a kid, trying to figure out how I'm going to, kind of survive and put food on the table. I launched Formstack, then called FormSpring, super excited when I got that first customer. It's like, it was the first time probably that I ever received a dollar of income or revenue without talking to somebody, right? Like, so even back when we were selling content management system, we'd have a sales process, talk through with the the potential customer, or consulting, obviously talk through them, and this person found the site, put in their credit card, I didn't know them, didn't talk to them. That was awesome. And my initial, obviously when I was working on it, I was like, had hopes and dreams of this thing, taking off and, making millions, right away, on my best days, and then on my worst days, had the opposite, thought that, this thing is going to go to zero, and I put all this work into it, and it's not going to put food on the table. So yeah.
Not only that, but we talked about SurveyMonkey and the issues with that. I still don't like SurveyMonkey because of the way that you link out. But I interviewed the founders of WooFoo. They came out soon after you. JotForm. FormAssembly, I don't know them. So basically competitors were starting to come in. And the investor didn't fully understand them. I'm looking at my transcript from my conversation with Kevin Hale, the co-founder of WooFoo.
Yep.
They took $18,000 from Y Combinator. That's what they gave at the time. They couldn't raise money from any outside investors. So Paul Graham and Paul Buchheit kicked in $50,000 each. And I think that was the full extent of the money they could raise at the time. But they had money, and you were bootstrapping, and you had a kid. They were kids. They had time on their hands to go and compete against you. You started to feel deflated because of that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was probably one of my lowest points in working on it. So the timeline, as I remember, is, I quit my job, start, working like crazy on the original idea. And I did a little bit of research to try to see, is anybody doing what I'm doing? And couldn't find anybody. And other than like SurveyMonkey. And so, part of my dreams, at the time was like, okay, I'm going to be the first. I'm going to be the only one who has this idea. It's going to explode like crazy. So heads down, coding like crazy, build it, launch it. And then 2 days later, I see JotForm comes out. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, how did clearly they were working on it at the same time that I was working on it. And, completely deflated. At the time, now I have a different perspective around competition, but at the time I was like, oh, this sucks. Like,
what's your perspective?
Yeah, I think, now today, I definitely see competition as being healthy. So, there's a balance, right? You don't want to see too much competition in the market. But if there's nobody in the market doing what you're doing, then that's probably a good sign that there really isn't a market for it, right? Competition in the market does.
Or maybe people just didn't discover it. Maybe they're not smart enough to notice it.
Yeah, it could be. But I mean, if there's an idea that I have and that, nobody's tried this, nobody's tried to tackle this, then that's more often than not a bad sign. Now, what I like to think about now is if there's competition in the market, how can I build something that's 10x better, significantly better, in terms of the value it gives to customers or, the way I can reach, address the market, with something new. Seeing some competition out there is probably healthy.
But at the time, you were starting to feel demoralized. Look at these guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They had money. They had reputation. The fact that WooFoo guys could go onto Hacker News and say, we have a form and get attention that way, right? That was huge.
Yeah, and WooFoo launched, probably within a few weeks after. So they announced their beta, and it was completely different than what they ended up launching later that year. It's like, kind of this flash app and all that stuff. But yeah, they got all of this buzz and hype and, all this press around it, at least, kind of within the design and developer circles, because of kind of all
they
that.
They were designers too. They had a design magazine, so they were reaching their potential customers. They were all geeking out on the design. This was your weakness, they had as a strength.
Yep.
All right. Yep. It's interesting, though, that despite that, you still did well. First year, do you remember what your monthly revenues were? I have it here. I could read it.
I want to say probably end of the year, probably a couple grand, few grand per month. What did I say earlier?
$1,000 a month.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. That's not bad, but it's not going to. It's going to pay for more than diapers, but not much more than diapers.
Yeah. So, by the end of the year, I was paying for diapers primarily through consulting work. So, I was spending, probably full-time job working on, consulting work for clients, and then, a second full-time job, working on kind of form stack. And, by the end of the year, just kind of, again, it was lots of ups and downs, right? It wasn't, and some of those ups and downs could happen within the same day, right? Somebody cancels and like this sucks. Nobody's ever gonna buy this anymore. And then somebody signs up, and I'm ecstatic. And so there was a point towards the end of that first year where I really questioned whether or not I should shut it down.
Focus on consulting, maybe come up with a new idea. So how do you, let me save this question. How do you decide whether to shut it down or not? Because at the end of the first year, you weren't making enough money. Maybe this was one of the experiments that wasn't meant to be. I want to know how you decide whether to shut things down or not, because you've made that decision a few times in your career. First, let me tell everyone about a company called ActiveCampaign. You guys integrate with ActiveCampaign, don't you?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Right. So someone can fill out a form saying something like, maybe a contact form that I would have on my site. They fill out the form saying, hey, Andrew, I love this interview. I like how you were able to talk about the difficulty of entrepreneurship. And then maybe I have a checkbox on the form that says also subscribe to my newsletter. Anyone who checks that box can automatically go to ActiveCampaign and be subscribed to my newsletter. And it's your form taking that data, making the decision about whether to send it to ActiveCampaign or not, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. And that's frankly the way to be. In fact, what we could do even is have a drop-down menu that has people also, if they check a box that says, I want to subscribe to your newsletter too, maybe we ask them, what are you interested in? So we're not sending them the latest newsletter, because frankly, newsletters are pretty dopey. Nobody wants to sign up to a newsletter. But it might be something like, can I send you 10 interviews that I think would be helpful? But how do I know it's helpful? Maybe the drop-down menu, after they check the box that says, yes, send me those 10 interviews, the drop-down menu follows up and says, what are you interested in? Do you want to know about companies that were started bootstrap? Do you want to know about companies that were in the SaaS space? Whatever it is, they pick from the drop-down menu, and then ActiveCampaign gets that data, and they allow us to customize what we send to people. That is a little too basic, but that's essentially what ActiveCampaign will do. If you want to get much smarter than that, what ActiveCampaign will do even further than that is watch what people are doing within those emails. What are they clicking on? Where are they going to? What are they spending time on the website? So someone could say, I really want to know about funded companies. but they're really watching a lot of videos about bootstrap companies. So maybe what we want is our emails to start customizing and telling them about bootstrap companies. Maybe what we want to do is, after they've watched the fifth video, come in with a sales sequence of messages where we sell to people only after they've been fully engaged and say, hey, you know what? You've liked these five videos and our software knows, and we might want to take it to the next level where you get access to all 1,000 videos. This is very, very basic marketing automation. If you're listening to the sound of my voice, you should see how basic marketing automation can improve your business and make it smarter and more relevant to your readers. But more than that, how it can, if you get a little smarter about it, how it can increase your revenue. All right. Usually marketing automation is a pain in the ass to put together. It's hard to install. It's hard to implement. It's hard to manage. Either the CEO ends up doing it himself because he can't find someone else, or he ends up hiring someone for tens of thousands of dollars a year. It's not unusual to go over 100 because the software is so tough. ActiveCampaign decided they were going to be easy to use so that you can get all the power of automating the marketing and the emails and the communication that you do with your customers. So if you want to try it out and see for yourself how easy it is, they are also giving you a free trial. All you have to do is go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. You'll get that free trial. Get a drink in your hand if you're a wine drinker. If you're, I don't smoke, so I can't say it, but I imagine if someone's smoking weed, they might want to just sit down and smoke. This is not good. This is not what the sponsor's looking for. Here's what I'm saying. Relax with this. You don't have to sit down and make a, I'm going to change my whole business decision with it. Sit down, watch a Netflix video, try ActiveCampaign, and you're going to see, even with half your attention watching BoJack Horseman on Netflix and the other half on the software, you're instantly going to have your mind blown and go, this is so easy. I actually can talk to my customers like they're human beings, and I can be responsive to what they've done on my site. So go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. You'll get a free trial. You'll get your second month free. You're going to get 2 free one-on-one strategy sessions with their consultants who will show you how to use this in your business to really change the way that you do business. And finally, if you're with another email provider and you've had this time watching BoJack Horseman on Netflix or something else, and you've decided this is for you, but you don't have the patience or the time to migrate from those other cheaper, not so good email service providers, they'll migrate you for free. All you have to do is go to activecampaign.com/mixergy. You know, I do these ads on the fly. I did an ad for you, I'll be honest with you. So yeah. You guys were sponsors of mine. I screwed it up because I'm doing it on the fly.
I heard about that.
What did you hear about it? What made its way back to the founder?
I heard that there was some, you mixed up FormStack and FormSpring and kind of ad lib something about FormSpring shutting down.
I'm obsessed with you, dude. Yes. So in the ad, I said there was this FormSpring thing. I couldn't not tell people about this whole FormSpring story that I'm hoping we'll get to here. And then apparently, and this I didn't realize, when I closed it out, I think I might have called you guys FormSpring instead of FormStack.
Yeah.
Living dangerously. I warned you before we start, we don't do any editing. This is partially what people love. I'm listening to the oral history of The Daily Show. Any fan of The Daily Show was going to love this. And part of what Jon Stewart decided to bring to the show was no editing. Now, they do a lot of prep to know, but the fact that there's no editing adds a sense of danger to the show, adds a sense of, if things don't work out, be human about it instead of being overly polished. And I find, especially with podcasting, we're getting to this point of excessive editing because NPR is doing so well. Yep. And we're getting to a place where it's almost like ads after they discovered Photoshop, where at first they did a little bit of editing. Let's get rid of this blemish, then a little bit more. And before long, models had no knees and they all had big boobs and, you know, elbows disappeared. And it was like this fake thing that, you know, that's just not at all connected to reality. And I don't want that to happen to my podcast.
Yeah, I like the way you think about that.
All right. At the same time, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
All right. How did you go from $1,000 a month in revenue? What did you do to bring in more customers and bring in sales?
Yeah, so part of it was really just kind of making the decision to stick with it, right? So, you know, SaaS is... SaaS can be a hard business, right? You invest a lot up front, and one of the big decisions I had to make is, you know, I could spend an hour of time and charge a client, say, $100 an hour, and know that I'm gonna, you know, as long as, you know, they pay their bills, like, I'm going to get that $100. Versus I could spend an hour working on potential features or the marketing side or, you know, something like that with a SaaS business, and I won't know for, you know, assuming my, you know, even if my, you know, CAC ratios and all that are right, like it may take a few months before I get that $100 back that I've invested into it. And so kind of at the end of the day, you asked kind of before the break, you know, how do I think about shutting things down or not? And it's part art, part science. You know, the science of it is really looking at the numbers and trying to, you know, see if the model works, and that, you know, as you know, people retain with the business, as people, you know, as you know, acquisition mechanisms are working, like, is that going to grow over time, and what does that look like over the time? Over time, but it's also kind of the art of the, like, do I believe in the vision of this, and am I excited about it, right? And so, with Formstack especially, one of the things that really really compelled me and still a big part of, you know, kind of our mission today is really putting putting the power that you get from programming into the hands of non-technical people. So it's really cool to be able to say, yeah, you know, one of the things that, like, I love today is when I run into people who are like, I run my whole business on Formstack. You know, we do this and this and this and this, and they don't have to hire a programmer. And I kind of felt like after doing consulting for so many years, I just really didn't love that model. Like, I felt like there are so many things that we all could do on our own without really having to hire a programmer and being able to provide that. So anyway, just that vision, like, kind of kept me going through, you know, kept me with it.
The vision, and you were willing to sacrifice revenue, right, from your consulting business to just invest more in the future of the software business.
Yeah, and part of that comes down to, and this is something, you know, that I talked to a lot of other people about, and it just, you know, and continues to be part of my own journey, is really understanding well what I want as an entrepreneur, as a founder, as a person, right? Like, what do I want to, what excites me, you know, waking up in the morning? What do I want to work on? And ultimately, I knew that, you know, I really wanted to build a successful product business. Building a successful consulting business really didn't excite me that much. What excited me was, you know, working with some of the particular clients I worked with, some of, you know, the, you know, products we were working on. Like, most of my, especially towards the end of my consulting career, most of my clients, almost all my clients were, you know, early stage startups. And, like, that's what fired me up, because, you know, I was with them trying to figure out, okay, how do we get to product market fit? What does the product look like and stuff like that? And so, you know, again, ultimately I knew I wanted to build a product business, not a consulting business. So that's kind of what
I see a change in 2017. I've gone through your website's iteration over the years. 2006, yep. It was a developer who was thinking about the features and writing almost like a Google Doc to explain what the features were. You were smart about having a demo. 2007, a year later, everything seems to change. You had buttons that looked very Web 2.0 on your site with the whole reflection on them.
Yeah, yeah.
You had fields that were so smart that Mashable started writing about you. Your whole design, you had a blog. The whole thing was very embracing of the Web 2.0 movement that was starting to take on. Is that you, or was that someone else who added that?
A lot of that was me, but, you know, by 2007, I hired two others in 2007. I hired another engineer in kind of spring of 2007, and then hired my second hire was somebody to do marketing full time.
And you were making enough money that you could bring these two people on?
You know, probably if I went back and looked at my books, I would advise myself, you know, not to. It was pretty, like, razor thin. But yeah, I felt like, but yeah, it was enough to pay them. You know, I went, you know, I had months, where I didn't draw a paycheck. You know, and, you know, my wife and I figured out how to make that work. But, you know, there was enough growth in the business at that time that, I felt like, you know, we could take, you know, kind of periods of, not drawing a paycheck to, you know, continue to invest in this and fund this. So yeah, you know, we drained all our savings, you know, we did incur, you know, credit card debt, you know, went probably the longest period. I think I went like 6 months without a paycheck or something like that.
6 months. You guys, and you and your wife, what, did credit card debt again?
And savings, right? So, I had built up some savings in that, you know, in
the job.
And the other thing, this other funny part of the story. So, for a while I was working that other job, this was before I started Formstack, I got really sucked into the online poker boom. And so, you know, played a bunch of online poker and probably built up another, you know, let's say, you know, 20, 30 grand in savings. Just
really? From poker?
Yeah, from poker. Wow. So that was enough to say, like, look, you know, there's enough in the bank where we can stretch that, you know, over enough time if I can't make this work.
Here's another thing you did 2007. You charged more. Pricing just shot up. And yeah, you were smarter about how you displayed your pricing.
Yeah, that $5 plan, didn't I?
Gone. Okay. Minimum was $9 a month, and I think I saw that climb. But more than that, you were doing this thing that some of the smart SaaS companies were starting to do, which is identifying for people which price they should go for. Not the cheapest one, but the most popular is a professional, which is $19 a month. You were starting to do that. You also started integrations. I see the PayPal integration start to come in, which means that people could use your form to collect money, which means you're a more valuable part of their business. And now revenue's starting to go up. I see where the business is going. Let's move on to FormSpring.
Yep. Yeah.
How did you come up with that idea, and how did you get it to explode in growth?
Yeah. So FormSpring's an interesting story. So fast forward to summer of 2009. So by this point, we were probably about 8 or 10 people in the business. I had raised a small angel round for what's now FormStack, then called FormSpring. This gets really confusing. So real quick about the name.
Yeah, please.
The original company, which is essentially the product of the SaaS business, the B2B SaaS business for online forms, is now called FormStack. It was originally called FormSpring. I go and launch this side project that's the social network, and in my stupidity, I guess, called that FormSpring.me, thinking that that was going to be essentially for publicity, marketing, maybe some lead gen into the FormSpring.com B2B SaaS business.
FormSpring.com was going to be the form site. FormSpring.me was going to be the Ask Me Anything social networking site. And you thought, great, it's different, and maybe some people will type in .com by accident, and then they'll go over to my form business, and I'll make some revenue from there. And the world didn't see that as different enough.
Yeah, at the time, you know, really thought, you know, in my wildest dreams, and even I'll talk a little bit more about the story, but even, you know, we kind of took bets internally about how many people were going to sign up in the first month, and like I forget exactly. I've got a picture somewhere of our whiteboard, but you know, let's say I said like 10,000 people or something like that, you know, and everyone was like, "You're crazy," you know. So at the time, you know, our thought process, my thought process was, you know, this may get some publicity and visibility, but it wasn't going to be a thing. It was going to be a side project that maybe things got slow on a Friday afternoon, like we'd hack on it. But you know, the B2B SaaS profitable, you know, money generating business was the core business. And so that's kind of why we had the name of this. But anyway, the social network took off so that, you know, there's just so much confusion between the two names that we renamed the original business FormStack. So
was that tough to go to your customers and say, hey, everything's working great. You know what? I changed my mind. We're going to call this thing FormStack.
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, it took a hit on SEO, took a hit on, you know, it was a lot of work to change the name and all that stuff. But it was also, you know, FormSpring was growing, the social network was growing so quickly that it was just, I mean, we had to do something because it created a bunch of confusion in the marketplace. You know, people were calling in to, you know, support, asking questions about the social network. When it was staff that, you know, that's answering questions about, you know, the B2B, you know, forms company. But yeah, so anyway.
So 2009, you launched FormSpring.me. It becomes a social network. I've got an early sentence from it. It's FormSpring is a global social network where members ask each other questions and learn more about each other through interesting, funny, and personal responses. I know we're going to, I'd love to spend an hour with you on this, frankly. I'm so fascinated by this. It really took over TechCrunch, Mashable, the tech world. Yeah. Why do you think this thing, do you remember how many users you had at your height?
We had probably a peak. We had 50 million monthly unique visitors on the site.
How much? 50.
Yeah.
50. Oh, that's even bigger than the numbers that I have here. 50 monthly. How did you get it that high? What did you do to it?
Yeah. So let me answer that as well as I never really answered your previous question, which is why did I create it? How did it come being? Because those are pretty tightly related. So So quickly, you know, summer of 2009, saw a handful of people use, you know, Formstack, the free version of the Forms company, as a way to get feedback on their blog. And so kind of the simplest use case was somebody would write a blog post, and at the end, they'd say, what do you want me to write about next? Ask me a question or tell me something, dump it in this contact form, and then they would get that email submission, you know, copy and paste whatever, you know, somebody wrote, and then respond to it, right? It was essentially a writing prompt. At the time, I was trying to blog, you know, a lot more of the time, and I just kind of like fell in love with that idea. I was like, I feel like I enjoy writing. I enjoy, you know, sharing my opinion and thoughts, but, you know, I probably, like most people, we're not wired to just stand on the stage and kind of blurt out something. You know, we're wired to, you know, have conversations back and forth. You ask me how I'm doing, you ask me, you know, an interview question, and I respond to that, and I can talk about myself for days.
Right.
So I started kind of, you know, tinkering around with this idea. Again, you know, had this profitable company, so, you know, the full-time job, so, you know, focused on that. But then kind of I was on a trip, went to a conference, and then started kind of like, you know, as people were speaking, started sketching out ideas of like, well, how could this work? You know, started sketching around wireframes for, can I create a service that basically is all around this concept? At the time, you know, Twitter was really kind of coming into the, you know, the public consciousness, and growing. But, you know, Twitter had that. At the time, everybody was saying, why would I use Twitter? Who cares what I had for breakfast, right? Like, what do I say on Twitter? And so that really connected with me, too, to say, well, if I get people to ask each other questions about themselves, they will, you know, be much more willing to create content, and that could be a really engaging thing. And so, you know, launched this as a, and at the time, too, I was really kind of into trying to understand a lot about like viral mechanics and kind of how do you measure that? How do you think through that? What's the psychology behind it? And so really kind of use that as a little bit of the testing ground of like, okay, how can we create, you know, low friction for people to ask each other questions and low friction for people to create content? And then what is that viral loop?
What did you do to make it go viral?
Really try to understand the psychology of it, right? And you know, is just that. So there really wasn't much in terms of mechanics. I mean, when we launched, did have the ability to share to Twitter and share to Facebook, but it was really about understanding, okay, why would people share? We usually don't share with others to just say, like, check out this cool website or something like that. We share because that sharing is baked into that utility. And so really the core viral loop within Formspring was that I want to, I have a fun experience talking about myself, and I want my friends or my network to ask me questions. So we made it really easy for you to share out to Twitter or Facebook or, you know, otherwise, you know, that ask me anything prompt. And so that was really the core hook. Like I would tweet out, ask me anything. My network would, you know, visit my profile page, see all the questions I answered, and like, okay, this is interesting. I've always wanted to ask how day this. So, you know, you ask a bunch of questions, and then you think, well, I wonder what other people are going to ask me if I create one of these things. So they create a Formspring account, tweet that out as well, and that's essentially the core of the viral.
And after they ask the question, you prompt them to create their own Formspring.me page.
Right, exactly. Yep.
And it would be something like Formspring.me/Andrew Warner, and now I can spread that on all social networks. I can embed it on my blog. Why did it, considering how fast it took off, and you started raising money, I think Travis Kalanick, how do you pronounce his last name?
Kalanick,
excuse me. Travis, he was one of the investors, right?
Yeah. I had an awesome group of early investors. So Steve Anderson led that round. Steve was one of the first investors in Instagram and Twitter. And,
was he at Redpoint?
Steve has his own firm, Baseline Capital, he kind of helps syndicate around with, you know, Travis, you know, Chris Sacca, and you know, Dave Morin and Kevin Rose, and just a great, you know, great group.
I see it. Mike Jones from LA.
Yeah, exactly. He was MySpace CEO at the time. Yep, exactly. Dick Costolo was an investor as well.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah,
because this was going to be the next. It was the next hot thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was growing like crazy. Yep.
And all this funding also went into Formstack. So basically, they were getting no.
No. So all this funding was in the
it became its own separate company.
Yeah. So, you know, long story short, you know, launched this thing. We, you know, went from zero to 1 million users in less than 45 days, you know, registered users. And after a couple weeks, I kind of just realized, like, oh crap, I'm going to bankrupt this company, you know, this 8-person, 10-person SaaS company, just on hosting bills alone. And so kind of scrambled to find some way to split up those two companies and raise money. So basically, you know, created a you know, complete separation between the two and raising money for the social network.
And that's when you brought Chris Byers in to run Formstack, an old friend. You went off to run, sorry?
Yeah, Chris and I started Bottle Software. We went to school together. Okay. So we had, you know, we started a company together. He was kind of in between things. And I said, like, look, here's what's going on. Can you just come in and help me find a CEO to run this? Luckily, he decided he was the best CEO to run it and stayed on board. So while I went off to focus on Formstream.
Okay. So why did it, I know you've written about this, but I've got to include this here in the interview. Why didn't it work out?
Yeah, there are a ton of reasons why. I mean, you know, I don't think it was just one thing. I'll talk briefly about, you know, so probably three core things. One is that viral loop that I talked about. It was extremely viral, and that mechanic worked really well, but we really didn't solve the engagement problem until probably pretty late in the company's history. So just briefly, you know, you get really excited and you get a bunch of questions on it. But then at some point, like, you know, if you created a Formspring account, I'd ask you a bunch of questions. But at some point, I'm kind of like, all right, I've asked you all the questions I want to ask you. Like, now let's talk about me. you know, it's probably the simplest way I can describe it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you'd have people's experience where they'd get a ton of questions from friends in their network in the first, you know, 1 to 30 days. And then that would just drop off pretty sharply, and then their engagement would drop off similarly. So, you know, we were growing fast, but if you look back at kind of our, you know, and at the time didn't really understand these metrics until kind of late in the company's life. Like, you know, if you looked at kind of their long-term engagement, you know, it just fell off a cliff. So, and at some point, you know, there weren't enough people to come in new to keep that top line number, you know, high. So we kind of had a bit of that shark fin effect, where we grew really fast, I think got to 10 million users in about, you know, the first 6 months. And then it just kind of slowly declined, you know, over the remaining years. So, you know, that was probably the biggest issue. We also, I think, just really didn't nail, we didn't shift to mobile early enough. So a very text heavy platform. And we started to decline, really, if you kind of look at the growth of, you know, Instagram and Snapchat overlaid with the decline of Formspring, like a lot of our users just went there, right? It was a very like mobile centric. Those were very mobile centric experiences, visual experiences. And so we just lost, you know, it was kind of Formspring was the hot thing for a while. And then, you know, our audience kind of went to the next social network, stuck with it. Probably the last thing is, you know, and you can, you know, I've written about this quite a bit and you can look a lot too, like, we grew so large so fast and had problems that a lot of other social networks have, which is, you know, abuse and stuff like that on the platform. And that we got a bunch of negative press about that early on.
Partially because of the anonymity.
Yeah, partially because of the anonymity. I also think the core problem we had was just, it came out of nowhere, right? And so you probably, for a lot of people, the first time you heard about Formspring was you read some article about some incident that happened or something like that. Whereas, you know, in a lot of those cases, you know, abuse or, you know, bad behavior was happening on like Facebook at the same time, but you're kind of like, okay, I know Facebook is this place where I see pictures of my grandkids. So that's like what Facebook is about. For Formspring, you know, the core engagement use case really wasn't that, but we just, you know, we had a hard time shaking that part of our brand and our reputation. And so I think that affected us, you know, long-term as well. So.
Okay. Let's just spend a couple of minutes. I know we're over, but I've got to ask you about Gel. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah. So the idea came from basically looking at the problems we face inside Formstack. So Formstack, we're about 125 employees. Most of them are remote. So we have our headquarters in Indianapolis.
Is Chris there? Because I think Chris is he published a blog about being a remote CEO for a while there, didn't he?
Yeah, so for a while he was remote. He moved back to Indianapolis a few years ago for a number of reasons. But yeah, but even, you know, so we have, you know, our biggest concentration of people in the Indianapolis area. But even, you know, if you walk into the headquarters here, like a lot of days it may only be, you know, 5-10 people in the office. Even people who live in Indy may just work from home or work at a, you know, a coffee shop or co-working space somewhere. So we, you know, we went through a period of rapid growth, remote team, and really, you know, and frankly, some of the things that we touched on in terms of what I learned about management, you know, over the years is I just felt like there was there are a lot of like best practices that, you know, as a manager, like I need to do this. I need to have regular one-on-ones. I need to think about performance this way. Like all these learnings that aren't rocket science, right? But as we kind of go through the day-to-day of firefighting and, you know, triage, like it all falls by the wayside. And frankly, like the core tools that we use as managers to kind of manage that process are meetings and emails. Like there's, you know, there are tools and platforms for managing your sales process or your dev process, you know, your marketing process, but felt like we needed some software to kind of instill these best practices for ourselves as a team. And so that's kind of the origin.
Is it just for, it seems like the focus is on the daily meetings, right? If we do a weekly meeting, would this still work for us?
Oh yeah, it'd work really well. So there are kind of two core components. One is helping facilitate any sort of, you know, stand up or check-in. So anytime you're trying to, as a manager, get information from your team on a regular basis, it helps do that. So some people use it as a replacement for, you know, stand-ups or check-ins, but a lot of people use it to augment that. So you may have use it as a way to kind of collect metrics or data from your team. And then you walk into the meeting, and the hope is that you can spend the time in the meeting really being more strategic and focused, rather than using meeting time going around the room and saying, okay, so what happened? What are these metrics? You have all that at your fingertips already, and so you can be much more effective in meetings.
Okay. All right. It's gel.com. What a great domain. Must have cost you a bundle to get that.
$10,000.
That's it. Four-letter domain. Easy to spell. Even I could spell it. J-E-L-L.
Yep, correct. Yeah, $10,000. I wrote a blog post about that as well, but basically, yeah, it was a long process to try to figure out, you know, how can we get a memorable domain name relatively cheaply. It's cheaper than most people think. If you're not tied to a name, there are a lot that can be gotten for, you know, even four figures.
So good. I even like Formstack. I love the name Formstack. I actually like it even better than Formspring.
Yeah, it's hard. I did too. Yeah. At the time it was a tough choice, but we used to have people call it Springform all the time.
Really?
Formstack's a great name.
You know what? In the past, I've been a little bit weak about saying, hey, this, I've always said, if I interview someone who was a recent sponsor, I mention it because I want to make sure that people understand that I've got some like connection to the company, but I never gave the URL in like any confident way, often didn't even do it, the URL that they would give in the ad. Do you mind if I give the, what are you actually doing here? Is there even a reason for people to use my URL? Probably not at this point. What the hell?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with what
you know.
What?
I'm just going to say, guys, I said he was a sponsor, and the URL for if you want to go sign up was formstack.com/mixerg. But frankly, even if you just go to their homepage, I think you're really going to be happy with having a form on your site. I'm not going to knock any competitors, even though you can tell that I have strong opinions about it. But I think a form, a proper form, needs to be on your site. You can't send people away from the experience. It's just too weird. Now, I understand that there's like behind the scenes stuff that's good for the company. If you send somebody away to another site, number one, you don't have to deal with integrating it into your site. But it's a weird experience. It's as it is. It's tough enough to say to somebody, can you tell me a little bit more about your business, about you, about your business, fill out this form. But if you're sending me a part to some other place, I don't feel the connection to you anymore. I feel like you've just shoved me off to somewhere else. Keep me in the conversation. All right. So I really like Formstack, but whether you use them or not, really just consider embed the form on your site and use forms much more than I think most people recognize that they should, because it's too hard for them. And forms are more than I could go on like this. I wish I would have started a form company. Do you know that there are form companies that were started years before you that are basically static form sites that are still producing revenue? It's a good business to be in because it's on someone's site. It's embedded. They're not taking it off.
Yeah, they're very high switching costs of that. Yeah,
and people always think about either surveys or feedback or contact. So much more. You really, like you said, you can make it into a programming experience. You ask someone a question, then you have a follow-up question based on what they answer. All right. Anyway, formstack.com/Mixergy. I really love the business. I wish I was an investor in your business. My two sponsors are totally close. Let me try to do it from memory. First, the company that will do your books right. It's called Bench. Go check them out at bench.co/Mixergy. And second is the company that will help you send out smart, engaging email marketing because it knows what people have done, what they're interested in, and then it lets you follow up with them based on what they've done and what they're interested in. It's called activecampaign.com/Mixergy. All right. Thanks so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Me too. All right. Yeah. Thanks. Bye.